Recording.
Yeah, recording.
Recording.
This
Mike has been replaced by some kind of wild animal. This is Mom's Basement Podcast, episode 26.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Final hour of a story age fatigue edition. Right, so we are we've been continuing our series on Mom's Basement playtests, mm-hmm. Where we playtest the game. Mm-hmm. We send the person responsible, the designer, a audio copy of the playtest, and then we get on podcast, and we not really review the game. If we critique it, we offer offer suggestions for improvement. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Since this is exclusively for in-development games. Speaking right. of which, if you have an in-development game that you would like to see undergo the Mom's Basement treatment,
yep.
email us at momsbasementpodcast@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. We'll get back to you. And if you email us a PDF, we'll add you to the list. There's only two games left on the list. Demi-Lich mm-hmm. and Keystone.
Yep, yep.
So yours will be added immediately after that, meaning you'll probably be played sometime in April.
Yep.
But as I said, tonight we played Final Hour of a Storied Age. We sat down to begin playing it at around 4 o'clock. Yeah. We finished at 10:30 or so. Mm-hmm. So it was a long session. We're kind of tired, kind of worn out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was around 6 hours. Aroundish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I know on past podcasts we've opened with a discussion and then saved the playtest edition part of it for the last half an hour, but we're going to reverse that this time. Yeah. We're going to talk about Final Hour of a Storied Age first, and then we're going to use that to transition to a discussion for the last half an hour, mm-hmm. which will be a discussion of high and epic fantasy.
Hopefully. Epic fantasy.
Since we've voiced some interesting opinions, controversial, angry, belligerent opinions about that in the past. We didn't introduce ourselves.
I'm Mike.
Least professional podcast on internet.
On internet. So.
Yes.
Yes, I am Mike.
I'm Rudy.
I'm William, sometimes Hank. Okay, so Final Hour of a Storied Age.
Yep. Okay, where do we begin with this?
Where do we begin with this?
How about character creation?
We could begin.
That's where everybody else would begin.
I mean, so let's talk about, just very briefly, what this game is for any listeners who might not know. Particularly if Dan's sight is down. The designer is mm-hmm. Dan Maruschak. At the moment, his sight's down, so we're going to link to the game, but if his sight's down, people may not be able to view the file.
Yeah, we don't know when it's going to get fixed, but hopefully it will be soon.
Okay, this is a game of epic fantasy role-playing. Does anything mm-hmm. more need to be said? It's a game that sets out to create the optimal epic fantasy experience. I guess what distinguishes this from something like Dungeons & Dragons or any of the other fantasy role-playing games is that it's more about structuring the game like a high fantasy narrative.
Yeah. Yes.
And having mechanics that make it feel more epic in scope. Mm-hmm. Okay, so character creation.
Character creation. Well, the way it works is you have a theme table mm-hmm. That you pull words off of, and you roll a d12. Or 2d12s, I'm sorry.
2d12s.
And then you add them together and find the entry on the theme table, and then you roll again and count down that many entries.
Right.
And roll again and count down that many entries, and keep doing this until...
Until you go over the bottom of the table,
yep.
At which point you start at the top again.
Yeah.
And you keep going until you get a word twice.
Yeah. Yep.
And then you use those words to form sentences. Those sentences become seeds, and those seeds become characters, they become your protagonist, your antagonist,
right.
and
all your supporting
settings, supporting characters,
yep.
plot elements, whatever, and they're used to build the larger world of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I really liked this
Yeah, as an idea generator, I think this is pretty outstanding.
Yeah, I kind of like this part as well.
I think that the theme table is both the strongest and the weakest element in this game.
I explain to them how you feel so first before we move on.
It's strongest because the words generated, the concept of generating a bunch of words that have real high fantasy overtones, like noble, fire, ice, ambition, family. Generating words like that, taking it them to make sentences, and using those sentences as the fundamental seeds, the starting point for world building, for creating all the elements of play, I think is fantastic. I think that's a great idea. The theme table itself and the theme table mechanics, I think, frankly, are deeply flawed. I think that, because, in our playtest, Rudy, about how many words did you generate?
I generated, well, let me count them up. There it is. I generated, 10.
Mike, how many did you generate?
I got 14.
I generated 3.
Yeah.
It is mathematically possible to only get 2 words.
Yeah, I haven't done the math, but the fact that, and this means that from the get-go, from the very start of the game, there's the potential for player input to be slanted highly towards one player or two players at the expense of one or two players. And this is actually a trend that I feel continues throughout the game, where it's easy for, where there's not a great mechanical balance of emphasis, of screen time, where it's very easy for players to become sidelined. And for example, since the number of elements you rolled on the theme table then is used to chart your, is used to determine who becomes the protagonist and the antagonist using the star charts. So someone who rolls more on the theme table is much more likely to become the protagonist or antagonist. And someone who rolled 3, like I did,
has no chance.
Has no, absolutely no chance of becoming the protagonist or the antagonist. Which means, A, you've just been put in a position where your contribution, your personal contribution to the world is immediately less than the other players. And then you're immediately confined to a less important role in the game than the other players, all based on random chance in a generation mechanic at the beginning of the game.
And if I may add one thing, the way this, if you become a supporting character, you automatically have a greater chance to become something more of a GM, since you will be more often playing the adversity role.
Will you be then? I mean, I think
your supporting characters roll a d20 on adversity, and it takes highest dice first.
They roll a d20 and a d10, but the antagonist rolls 3d12. So I would think that would almost balance it out.
It doesn't really, because it all it takes is one d20 roll to overcome all the d12s.
That's true. That's true.
And in practice,
that's exactly what happened. So that's personally what I would like to see. Well, let me add one more thing about the star charts. With the star charts, you take your words, you divide them into sets of 8 if you have more than 8, and then you plot those sets of 8 on what's called a star chart, which is basically it's kind of like an astrology chart, but basically it's a circle. You plot points in the circle, and then you connect the dots, and the player with the most intersections in the middle of the chart becomes the protagonist. The player with the second most becomes the antagonist. And then after that, the star charts are discarded and have no more impact on play.
Yeah, that's kind of a shame, since they were somewhat fun to make personally.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun making the star charts, and I wish there was more mechanical relevance.
Right, and I feel like the mechanical relevance they had was not necessarily great, was not necessarily beneficial, because I feel like, personally, I think that every mechanic in a game, the baseline for determining the value of a mechanic in a game should be freeform plus player consensus, meaning that your mechanic has to be better than what would happen if the players just sat down, took the elements in front of them, and decided using their own judgment what they were going to do. In this case, I don't think the star charts succeed. I think that if you took all of the different sentences that people had come up with and looked for the one that felt to the players most like the antagonist, it would lead to a more thematically interesting result, a more cohesive result in terms of plot, and it would eliminate all of the time spent drawing the star chart, which once again is then discarded. And it would also allow players to say, well, you know what, this person perhaps got shafted a little bit on the theme table, maybe we can make their character the antagonist. Or maybe we'll make their character the protagonist. And it gives, instead of having a limited role breed an even more limited role, it would allow a moment for the players to come and kind of reverse things that random chance may have
messed up.
Exactly.
Yeah, yes. That's a good point.
And that I'm trying to figure out how to say this. The way this bred out, in my mind, it seemed more obvious that Hank's character might have been an antagonist. Or mine, even.
Right.
But we had to fish around and find a way for the protagonist to actually be the protagonist and the antagonist to be the antagonist.
Right.
That is one part that I kind of like, but mostly don't, because you do have to work with some creative boundaries and get things together.
And that's true.
And I actually do kind of like that. Yeah.
And I do like what he was trying to do there, but I think that the theme table to seeds thing alone offers those kind of creative boundaries that are a good impetus for, creative thought.
Exactly.
And I don't think the star chart really contributes that much on that front. And what actually ended up happening is in play, both because of what you said and because of the randomness of determining who's the adversity player and who's the viewpoint player in any given scene, my character actually ended up kind of becoming the antagonist of the game just because I was playing the adversity role more often.
Right.
Yep.
And because the protagonist ended up being the viewpoint of nearly every scene in the beginning of the game.
I think I can save that complaint for later, though. Because there's a more detailed reason why that is.
Well, so we're wrapping up character creation then. My recommendation, make it so, and this would require a kind of a level of rewriting of the game that's unlikely to happen this late in development, but I would say make it so that everyone rolls the same number of times on the theme table. Close to it. So people get the same number of seeds, end up with the same number, get the same number of entries, end up with a similar number of seeds, and have equal capacity to contribute to the beginning of the game. And I would say that the start charts, I love them, but either make them more relevant to the game or take them out entirely and let people choose who's going to be the protagonist or the
antagonist. Do have one thing to add real quick before we get out of this. The trait creation, I actually love.
Yes. Yes.
That was actually a very good
thing.
Because
that was really simple and very...
Yeah, the point is to make it very flexible, but you're stuck with only four to create, which means you have to make them so that each one of those will be useful in different situations.
In different situations.
Right.
And so that's kind of hard, but very good.
Right.
I like that.
Right. Yeah. So they're both broad and distinct enough, and also shoehorn fit nicely with your character concept.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, I did like traits.
Absolutely.
So.
That's definitely there. Okay, moving on to
the alignment track. I wasn't sure how useful and relevant that was.
It wasn't terribly relevant. It came up a few times.
It came up.
That's true.
But it seemed like really it was sort of peripheral. It didn't
really... Right.
It seemed more instinctual than necessary.
Right.
Because it was like we'd go back later and change the alignments with our story dice.
Right.
If we figured out we needed it.
Right.
But it didn't seem like we needed it.
Right. It certainly doesn't take anything away from the game,
though.
No. Think it may be there mostly for flavor.
Yeah.
Or to remind people, oh, you know, this NPC is, or this supporting character is supporting this guy, but maybe I can... I think it gives some mechanical weight to the kinds of plot movement you'll be trying to make happen in the game, which is to say that if you want to take a supporting character or an NPC and convert them to your side, to recruit them, basically, it gives a way to mechanically express the fact that you've converted them, that you've recruited them.
Yeah.
And it didn't seem totally necessary, but it didn't seem like...
It didn't seem like a waste, either.
Like it was...
Yeah.
Okay. On to chapters.
Yes. Viewpoint. Yay.
Oh, yay. I think this is where I get my complaint come in. Yeah. Viewpoint. Okay. Rule one. Don't give the antagonist such a major advantage for two-thirds of the storyline to get his viewpoint in.
You mean the protagonist?
The protagonist. My apologies there. He rolls a d20 on viewpoint as his base dice always.
Yeah.
The other player, the player that plays adversity...
For the first plot segments.
Yeah. I keep messing this up, but yes, thank you for saving my hide there. Adversity can add dice to their rolls. I think the antagonist rolls a d12.
Yep.
And the supporting characters roll
d10.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But when you add dice, you have to add a d10 first if you didn't have one.
Yeah.
Then a d12, then the d20.
Right.
Yeah.
And how you determine viewpoint is highest number first, if tie, go to the next highest dice if you had a second. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if they're all ties, there's something
and
weird
this
happens.
Is determining who is the focus of a scene.
Mm. Yes. This determines whether you can advance your plot structure and win, in quotes.
Right.
Because there's a winner, but it's...
Which is something else I might... But, yeah. And so what happened in play is that for basically the first six segments of the game, Mike was playing the protagonist, and he continuously outrolled Rudy to the point that Rudy didn't even get to introduce his antagonist until very, very late in the game because I kept rolling well for adversity. Mm. So what happened very quickly is I managed to best Mike a few times as the adversity player, enough that I was able to get an additional die for the purpose of rolling viewpoint. So I, as my supporting character, did get a few viewpoint scenes of his own in.
Right.
But you actually finished your subplot.
I did finish my subplot. But that pushed Rudy even further to the back, so it was just going between Mike and me, and Rudy was sitting there, and occasionally playing adversity.
Right.
But his adversity character was so far away from the centerpiece of what was going on that he couldn't actually move her to interact directly with Mike and be the primary adversity in Mike's scene because he would have been taxed for it by other game mechanics.
Yes.
Yeah, see, that's a problem.
And that doesn't even mention the fact that I would have had more traits kept that weren't exhausted while his were just starting.
Right, right, and that's another thing. And so this is... another situation, and we had this issue a little bit in Deathbird Black, where advantage becomes cumulative, where advantage builds advantage, builds advantage, builds advantage. But it was more severe, I felt, in this game.
Yeah, this is the actual snowball theory.
Right, where dice breed more dice, breed more dice, and if someone gets locked out early, they stay locked out.
Yeah.
And you think a D8 to a D6 wouldn't be that much of an advantage, but it kind of was.
It really was.
Pretty significant.
Seemed like that.
Now, Rudy, you're the one who got locked out. You want to talk about...
I don't know. I was just pretty much sitting there with my thumb up my ass for half the game here. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't really know any other way to put it, but it was... the scenes that I did have were fun.
Right.
But they were kind of really few and far between.
I noticed they were really short, too.
Yeah, they tend
to
be
that way,
really short, yeah.
And
because I didn't have, once I got brought in, I didn't have much to work with as far as, you know, adversity.
Right, and yeah, as far
it
as
didn't,
traits.
A lot, I felt a lot of the time it didn't really make sense for me to be doing anything in the...
Yeah.
Because by the time I did come in, it was so late and so much of the story had already been unfolded that it really didn't make a lot of sense for me to, you know.
Yeah, that's true. I was going to say something, and it disappeared. I feel like...
In fact, for a lot of the game, I thought we were doing something wrong, but I don't think we did anything wrong.
Right. We may have done something minor wrong, but I don't think it would have affected the turnout.
Yeah. Right.
And in other RPGs, the way we would have solved a situation like that would have been to take that player and introduce them into the scene as an NPC or something.
Right.
But the process for delegating responsibility in this game, it makes what the player is doing seem kind of arbitrary.
Right.
And also bringing in a supporting character after they've finished their personal micro plot track. Mm. Is strange and counterintuitive in some ways, in that they don't just get to exist along with the character they've teamed up with and keep using their traits. They have to give their dice to the viewpoint character.
Right.
And how that translated into the supporting character having a role in the scene in character was very confusing. And whether they got to use their traits or not.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since in some cases, in my case, my supporting character still had hella active traits. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't clear whether or not he could use those active traits, or if he could use any traits, period, when he was lending support to the viewpoint character.
That's true.
I have one other complaint, but this one's specifically about NPCs.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't hardly ever seem worthwhile to put active traits into NPCs when you could just put them into yourself.
Into yourself, see, that's a good point.
Yeah, that's true.
Because, on one hand, the NPC, you would have to deputize it first, I believe, if you wanted to add it in.
I don't know, you deputize players,
you deputize,
not NPCs.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you could still bring... As long as you had paid the creation tax for that NPC,
correct.
And you didn't have... And the tax to get him into the scene wasn't prohibitively... Prohibitively...
Prohibitively.
Thank you. Hi. Then you could bring him into the scene. Mm. But you would have to pay sturdy dice to activate his traits.
And you'd probably have to pay a tax just to create him, because there's always a minimum of
to create him.
And but that one could be put into yourself.
Yeah.
You see my point there?
Right. Mechanically, there's not...
The resource management is a little wonky.
See, I'm not sure if the taxes really serve the purpose they're supposed to.
Mm.
They don't serve any purpose at all, as far as I know. Because the ones that you're going to want to come with you, you're just going to burn the points to have them travel with you. At the end, if you have the extra...
Right. I mean, the purpose... His stated purpose is to prevent people from... introducing NPCs and characters who will basically compromise not the realism, but the thematic integrity of the game. It's to keep people from creating cop-out NPCs to solve problems in the game and making it so that people look back to characters that already exist and situations that have already happened to find the answers for the future, which makes sense, but I think Rudy had an objection.
Well, but it winds up really kind of hamstringing the plot in some cases when it's like, I want somebody playing this guy, but you're going to have to pay too much tax to have him in there. And also, I just don't like the idea of paying tax to create NPCs, because... Characters are so important.
Creativity tax.
Yeah. It's like characters are so important to the way most high fantasy stories, you know. And especially having a lot of characters, some that show up and come back whenever.
Right. It's fundamentally important, too.
And there's always those few that just show up at once and then just disappear.
Disappear, exactly.
In fact, that's a hallmark of epic fantasy.
Yeah, exactly.
It really
is.
From Tolkien all the way on out.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
and
also, fundamentally, I don't like the idea of punishment mechanics in a game. And maybe this isn't a punishment mechanic, but it's a prohibitive mechanic. It's a mechanic that exists to curtail creativity and to limit what you can do, as opposed to presenting options. I think there's a difference between mechanics that exist to offer a range of options for play, with maybe some options omitted intentionally, and mechanics that, or attacks that are about, no, you can't do this,
right,
because...
It's a slap on the wrist.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like.
I mean, there's one example from our actual play that came up that just seems to be kind of going in my head right now, but it has nothing to do with the tax.
Hmm.
But it did curtail the creativity. The Undertow.
Hmm.
What about... Oh, yeah! at one point...
Yeah, I'm...
Well, you're talking about the distinction between passive environmental hazards and active ones,
yes,
right? And how the... Having a... Oh, wait, was it the under...
It was the first time the Undertow when you wanted to snag me.
Oh, yeah, when I wanted to actively snag you with the Undertow, that would have cost too much to introduce into the scene.
Right.
Which seemed kind of unfortunate at the moment, because it was more dramatic than what I would have had happen.
Instead, we had something really lame happen that I ended up beating, I think.
Yeah, just totally destroying.
And it wasn't very epic at all.
But what are some more positive points of the actual play of the game? We talked about some positive points of character creation.
I didn't have much in this one, but having to work out a way to solve everything with what you had,
exactly.
That I liked.
Right. I did like that a lot.
It did kind of end up being a little flaw, because it didn't always seem to fit, like fighting fire with my drunkenness.
Yeah.
Because I had an ability called Drunken Charisma. And that was the only one active, and I ran out of story dice, and I had to have this one go bye-bye or lose three in a row before I would lose the exchange.
Right.
And fighting fire with drunkenness just didn't... It was a stretch, to say the least.
Right. And yeah, sometimes they did feel like a cop-out, but more often than not, it felt like you had to stretch yourself to come up with an example, but not stretch yourself too far.
Too much.
Right.
Yeah.
For the most part, everything did fit, because the examples displayed were actually very good on that end.
Mm.
And I think the examples in the book also, may I note real quick, on the actual play, fairly good.
Yeah.
It was understandable. That
have one thing I have to talk about with the examples, and it's a minor quibble, but it's something I picked up on. The examples in the book, in my opinion, reflect ideal play and not actual play. Because, for example, take the character creation example. The first example of how to create seeds, use them to generate characters, determine who the protagonist and antagonist is. The character that ends up flagged as the antagonist by the system in that thing is a character whose sentence clearly predisposes the character to be an antagonist.
Right.
And the same thing with the protagonist. It's someone who's has pretty clear potential as a protagonist. In play, we found this isn't necessarily the case. There's nothing about the star chart that makes it so that the second player with the second most connections has a really antagonistic sounding set of terms.
Right.
In reality, it's totally random. And most of the examples in the game text were like that, where things just seem to work out a little too ideally, where the randomness present in the system reflects itself in the play examples in a way that's really ideal. You know, the randomness generates ideal results.
Right.
When in play, the randomness did not generate ideal
results.
That's very
true.
No. It was okay, but...
Yeah, I think we did okay for a generation, but...
And I will say this much, if we had a better star chart on Hank's character, it would have worked out actually pretty well.
Yeah. Potentially, but it wouldn't necessarily have given you a protagonist and an antagonist...
No, it wouldn't.
...who made intuitive sense.
Right.
In the way that his examples do. Where the character who ends up being the antagonist is the one whose seed is obviously the antagonist.
Yeah.
You know,
all the snowball seems to come from the list itself in a way. Now, I mean, you can fix all the other stuff individually, but everything kind of snowballed bad from that point, because one person got shortchanged.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, actually, although it did transition to Rudy and being shortchanged by the random.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
But I feel like this... I feel like everything in this game works except the random chance. Right. I feel like if you took out a lot of the random chance elements in this game and rested more heavily on mechanics that actively structured the progression of play instead of passively structuring the progression of play and allowed for player common sense to be used to determine things like the antagonist and the protagonist. And there's this sensation, I think, in gaming that leading hard on the common sense of the people at the table, on the good judgment of the people at the table, is somehow a faux pas, is somehow a bad design choice. And sometimes it is, but I think more often than not, it can generate a better result than absolute random chance.
Yeah, I don't think there's very many cases where leaving it up to people at the table is a bad thing. There are a few, like you said, but and not many.
And often that's a function of a dysfunctional group.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly.
Not to say that you should replace all mechanics with player judgment.
No.
Just that, as I said earlier, the mechanics should be intrinsically superior to player judgment.
Mm. Right. Okay.
One thing that I did like about this, though, is that every step of it takes collaboration.
Yes.
And that's something that he really emphasized in the text. And it works in play.
Yeah.
The way
you
said it, it worked. So.
Absolutely.
That's one thing that...
Very collaborative game. Yeah. And absolutely no complaints on that front.
Yeah, no.
We really were forced to work together every step of the way. Even points when one player had the viewpoint, had the spotlight,
mm-hmm.
and was making the decisions, often they'd say, well, how about this, guys? And you talk it over, and someone would contribute something, and it would evolve that way.
Yeah, because we wanted to make it sound plausible, but we weren't quite sure. And there were a few cases where we were absolutely wrong to actually use that. So
very collaborative. It would definitely, that worked.
Yeah.
So that leaves Endgame, I guess. Let's talk about Endgame.
Okay. There's not really a whole lot to this, I guess. Because Endgame is dependent on
who completes
first. Because the subplot doesn't determine the end necessarily.
Mm. Right.
And it determines a little bit on how far the opposing protagonist or antagonist, depending on who won the game, actually gets in their storyline.
Right.
Which is okay, but...
I mean, the game ends when someone completes their plot track.
Right.
And that it ends with that character as a winner. Oh, excuse me, a supporting character can't win.
Mm.
So when the antagonist or the protagonist complete their plot track, the game ends with that character victorious. And if the protagonist wins, but the antagonist had progressed one-third of the way through their plot track, it's a slightly bittersweet ending.
Mm.
If the protagonist wins and the antagonist had progressed at least two-thirds of the way through their plot track, it's a very bittersweet ending with major personal change. And I thought that was good, because that's really reflective of the way epic fantasy actually ends. Someone is permanently changed.
Yeah.
Particularly the protagonist is changed in a way that makes it so that he can't fully rejoin his community.
Mm.
Right.
And sometimes, as in Lord of the Rings, his community is destroyed. Or changed in a huge way.
Hmm.
And I think that's definitely good. I'm a little iffy on the potential for the antagonist to win the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems... In high fantasy, that seems a little bit out of place.
That seems like it shouldn't even be possible in high fantasy.
Yeah.
And this is one of these strange cases where my personal preference is in conflict with what I believe should be happening based on the stated goals of the designer.
Yeah.
Based on the stated goals of Dan Maruschak, to have this be a game that simulates high fantasy, that's about small people being able to score big victories against great evil, I feel like having the possibility there for the antagonist to win really runs counter to everything you would expect from the premise.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I like more choice, I like more freedom, I like more tension about the outcome. So I like the fact that the antagonist can win personally.
Same here, I'd actually prefer it that way. Because while he's trying, like you said, while he's trying to aim for this epic fantasy, which you don't really ever see the antagonist winning, it's better in this case if he does.
Yeah, or no, she. I think it would definitely be better served.
If they have the option to win?
Yeah.
Yes.
Because or else, what's the fun of playing the antagonist?
Yeah, what's the point of even having that?
If you know you're going to lose.
Yeah. To enjoy hamming it up as the antagonist, playing the big bad evil guy. The moment of defeat is sometimes a choice as part of that role.
That's true. But in a game like this that's structured the way it's structured, I think having the win option in there is a lot better.
Okay.
Yeah, and as we said before, it does seem much harder for the antagonist to win than the protagonist.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. The game definitely makes it easier for the protagonist to win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
More likely that the protagonist will win.
Yeah.
But that just didn't seem fair, but
And
it does meet that end where he's trying to give the edge to the protagonist, so the protagonist wins way more often than he loses.
And if the dice mechanics are working ideally, the viewpoint dice, if they're working ideally, they should create a scenario where things start to get really tense at the end because the antagonist starts showing up more.
Right.
Mm.
And starts getting more powerful. Unfortunately, in our playtest, they didn't work ideally, and that's not what happened at all.
Because the difference between a D10 and a D12 isn't as big as a D12 and a D20.
Right. I mean, the antagonist started to show up more, but at that point, the antagonist had been so thoroughly sidelined and diminished by everything that had happened in the game before that it was in... That just... Being in the game more didn't necessarily add
didn't
more
really
tension.
Yeah, because she was just starting.
Yep.
So, any final thoughts on A Storied Age? I'm gonna use that for as long as I can. This is my last chance to manipulate the title of this game.
Yeah, my final thought. Yeah, do not like my bad. I'm sorry for say it this way, but it just did not. Ring right with me in most ways. There's a lot of things I would rather do than this. That's just my personal take on the game, though.
I thought it was okay. And one thing that I was surprised at is how easy the flowcharts are to use. When I looked at the flowcharts the first time, I was like, holy shit, look at that.
Yeah.
But they actually helped a little bit. They helped out. So. But, as far as the game, I think it has a lot of potential, and I think it's a...
Needs some refinement.
Yeah, I think just...
I feel that some of the randomness in the system...
Yeah, I don't like any type of random chance, but... Because I always get fucked in the ass.
Ideal group, too.
Yeah, I always get fucked in the ass by the random chance.
I'm saying that about random chance, because we do like some...
Yeah,
but we don't like it highlighted, I think.
Right. Yeah.
Rudy is very anti-random chance. Yeah. And with good reason, you have never not been fucked by random chance.
No, I haven't.
Excuse the double negative.
Yeah.
Although, you have also been fucked by completely strategic mechanics.
That's true.
In games that you have designed yourself.
That's true.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
So. My final thoughts. One quick minor... Well, I don't know how minor it is. But enjoy the chapter. I felt players got sidelined.
Yeah, that's kind of...
They do.
There's
kind of smarmy for... enjoy having your thumb up your ass for the...
And I understand that there are some narrative games that are really designed to give people a break to think about what they're going to do next. But I felt like there was a potential there for you to spend more time... enjoying the chapter than playing the game.
Yeah.
And I would have liked it if there were more ways to just really grab someone who was on the sidelines and thrust them in the game, besides saying, oh, I'm delegating you the arcs.
See, here's the thing. I actually have a different viewpoint of that, but that's because I had about five turns in a row as the protagonist.
That's true.
When it got around to me taking a break from the game, I absolutely loved it because I was playing for about an hour and a half between myself and the whoever with adversity.
Right. That's true. That's true.
Very true.
My final thought on Final Hour is that I love the title. I don't think you could have better title for a high fantasy game than Final Hour of the of a Storied Age, because it gets at something fundamental about high fantasy, and I'm building my segue here. Something fundamental about high fantasy that I think is absent in a lot of fantasy role-playing games, which is that one of the most important and really captivating things about fantasy novels, high fantasy novels, and good ones like Tolkien's novels, is that they really do take place at the end of an age, not in the midst of it. They take place at a time of hugely important transition between one world and the next. And there's a few reasons I really like this. I mean, first of all, it builds, there's that sense of urgency and tension and importance. You are living in the final hour of magic and of supernatural powers and of all of this and of fairies and elves and whatever. This is the end. You're living at the climax of a storied age, to put it in a different way. Also, let's face it. When do most people begin reading high fantasy? When do people get hooked on epic fantasy? It's not when they're children. It's not when they're, you know, 6 or 7 usually.
Right.
It's usually not when they're 26 or 27. Right. It's when they're 16 or 17. Yeah. When they're literally in a kind of personal final hour of storied age. When they're entering adolescence. When the magic, to put it in parentheses, of childhood is starting to diminish, but is still present and felt, and when life is filled with a new sense of urgency and of change and of importance. And I think that's what's so captivating about Tolkien's books and about other types of high fantasy of that sort, for that type of audience, is that it really gets at the emotional meaning, the emotional state of adolescence. And so I think Final Hour of a Storied Age is perfect. Perfect title.
Yeah,
I definitely agree with that in every way you said it. I mean, mind you, these days, kids are getting into it more at around 13 and 14.
Right. Since Harry Potter and all of that, since the entrance level has, the bar to entry has been lowered because you've got a lot more children's.
And there's different reading high levels fantasy. Still, of course, though, too, for this fantasy between your 13, 14. Then you have another level about the 16, 17. Right. And then there's even some adult stuff now.
Oh, there is adult stuff now. Absolutely. But I know that's when I was really into Tolkien, when I first got into Tolkien. And I think that's when a lot of people, especially this particular kind of epic fantasy, as opposed to adolescent fiction kind of fantasy like Harry Potter. I think that's often when it happens. So, high fantasy. Epic fantasy. Let's talk about it.
Yes.
I think that epic fantasy is shit.
Really, in all cases and in all ways, you don't think there's any thing redeeming about epic fantasy?
I think the battles are cool.
See, I disagree.
Maybe it's just because I'm so warped or whatever, but I can't.
Jaundiced? Cynical?
Yeah, everything that I do when I think of, you know, when I think of creating fantasy, and I create fantasy a lot. I haven't written any fantasy, but I create a lot of fantastical. You know, I have a setting, and I have a fucking, I have a t-shirt and all that. But, everything I do, I try to get away from high and epic fantasy, because the outlook of the world in high fantasy is just not my outlook, and that's probably something with me.
Right.
And, And it's just, I just really can't get into it. I have a real hard time getting into it. Because of that.
Yeah.
Well, no, you can go ahead.
I was just going to say, personally, I actually kind of like it, but I do need to preface this by saying that I'm not exactly the biggest fan of high fantasy. I like pretty much all kinds of fantasy fairly equally. But I do like high fantasy for what it offers differently from the other types. I like to spread myself around a little because I do get bored of something if I see it a lot. And getting it thrown in the face can absolutely suck if you don't like it. But there are right ways to do it and wrong ways to do it. And I can't really tell you what's right and what's wrong because I didn't watch or read enough of this stuff. But you know it when you see it, I think is the best way to say it.
Yeah, you do know it when you see it. I have a very ambivalent relationship with high fantasy. As I said, I'm not sure if there is any series of books or book that was more influential to me during important parts of my development than Tolkien's Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. I don't think there are many books that I remember more fondly, especially when it comes to having, I guess you'd say, warm memories, whatever that means, as opposed to thinking, oh yeah, I read that book and I totally related with all of the awful things that happened in it and the awful characters. And I mean, I can definitely, and there are some books that I would rate higher than, or much higher than Lord of the Rings, maybe in my personal preference. But in those cases, those are all books where I saw a character and I said, wow, that character is really nasty and awful, but I just can relate. It's just, this is such a true psychological portrait, or this is just so profound, or whatever. But once again, nothing brings up those feelings of nostalgia and of emotional possibility, maybe, like high fantasy does. And what's frustrating now is that if I go and re-experience some high fantasy thing, kind of like what Rudy mentioned, I feel very jaundiced, very cynical when I'm reading it, and I feel like, oh, this doesn't represent anything resembling human experience. And the funny thing, though, is when I read, if I were to pick up the Monster Manual for D&D, or if I were to pick up, or the manual for Final Hour of the Storied Age, you start to get those feelings got from the cool high fantasy you experienced as an adolescent. And then if you try to bring it to play, or if you try to read an actual play, you just get overwhelmed, almost suffocated by the cheesiness of what you're doing. And it's very depressing, frankly. And I mean, Dan Maruzchak kind of gets at that in his introduction, I guess, when he says that a key feature of epic fantasy is the scope of the action, and I'm quoting now. The core of an epic fantasy story is a protagonist defending what is good about the world, for some definition of the world, from sources that would tear it down. It's about linking personal action and personal virtue to bigger and broader things, things worth saving. In the cynical world we live in, there is constant pressure to be small-minded, hopeless, and complacent. Guilty, guilty, and guilty. Epic fantasy heroes don't give in to that mindset. They stand against the tide of evil. The stories don't tell us it's easy to do that, because it usually isn't. But they tell us it's right to do that, and it's nice to be reminded. And I guess I am so far beyond that point. I am so personally defeated, so deeply cynical, that I can't imagine a world like that. And I can't put myself in the shoes of a character like that. Not easily, anyway. Not convincingly. I don't know if you guys have...
I definitely could still see that place still. But I know that's not. I know that sort of thing isn't going to come to fruition in this world. I have a cynical view as far as it comes to this world. Shit is not going to happen. Nothing is going to fucking happen. But there's still that place somewhere that you can imagine in the alternate worlds theory, so to put it.
Right,
like,
and that
out there.
And that place, I think, is very important. That place where you can imagine that kind of possibility. And you get taunted and tempted, I think, by that place. When you get just close enough to something like this to feel childhood nostalgia, to feel something resembling the sense of fascination or captivation that you felt when you first experienced these worlds and played these games.
Right.
And then you take a step closer, and it's just like you're suffocating in mediocrity.
Yeah.
And I think that because of that, I hold games like this not to a lower standard, and I don't dismiss games like this, but I hold them to an even higher standard. Mm. Because if they can't bring me past that threshold and make me enjoy it in anything resembling the way I would have 10 years ago, then the disappointment is profound.
Yeah.
And so maybe I've been harsher to this game than I perhaps should have been, but...
Well, we all have our own personal bars and what we were trying to meet. Like, what were yours, Rudy? What were you trying to see in this?
Or what do you try to see in high fantasy in general?
Yes.
Well, I don't really... I was never really at that point of nostalgia with high fantasy.
But you really liked Tolkien, didn't you?
I liked Tolkien, but I never really was there at the point with the characters, I think.
Oh, okay.
I more identified with Sauron and the orcs and kind of, so I was never really into the ethos of high fantasy. It was more that I just liked the world building and the kind of ship inside a bottle type of feel, you know, where it's like...
Wow, you just referenced a really, really old essay that I wrote.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right, the popsicle stick.
USS Constitution.
Yeah.
But
yeah, no, it kind of... No, it's not... I think what I was trying to get out of this game was just a good tool for creating stories, which I think it is.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really good at pacing the stories that you create.
Absolutely.
Was something that...
The pacing and scene structure stuff are very good.
The exchanges feel, you know, rooted in something. They feel tense.
Right.
And it, you know...
Absolutely.
But that's all I was looking for. But as far as high fantasy, I don't know. I never really got that into the ethos. I'd just rather a world where people, you know, say nigger and rape people and, you know, do whatever.
I mean, you were talking earlier about who you related to most. One guess who I related to most in Lord of the Rings books.
Boromir?
No, Boromir is on probably top five.
Gandalf?
Gandalf number two.
Sam? Yeah.
Sam, I always felt, was the most believable, compelling, likable, and personally relatable character in Lord of the Rings. Yeah. Frodo was always kind of distant. Gandalf was cool. He was hella cool.
Yes. Yeah.
But not very relatable. You couldn't say, I feel like Gandalf. Because you can't... I mean, Gandalf isn't even human. He's some kind of
angel or whatever.
Right. But Sam, and I think the way Sam was written and presented as a character helped to elevate the Lord of the Rings beyond what we often see in other, in the epic fantasy that comes before it, like Beowulf and the Odyssey and all of that, and the high fantasy that comes after it. There's something about the humanity of Sam.
Yeah.
And the second part of The Two Towers takes a lot of shit. And I'm not talking about the movies here, which I hated, but that's another podcast for another time. But the second half of The Two Towers book is far and away my favorite part of the book. There's some humanity there that isn't present in the same intensity elsewhere in the book. And there was something there, just reading those pages, just experiencing the dynamic between those three very different characters of Gollum and Sam and Frodo. There's something there. Hmm. I don't know. But that's really what I don't know. I liked about it. Who did you relate most to? Lord of the Rings.
See, that's the weird thing, and this is going to get me a lot of flack. Mm. I could not read the books whatsoever.
Really?
But that happens to be because of how I read books.
Mm.
I don't read books very well.
Mm.
I go through them very slow, and reading Lord of the Rings was not any easy thing at all. It took a while to even get through the first book for me, so I didn't end up finishing it because the effort put through for me is so much harder than reading it, than doing anything else.
I'll tell you this. In college, English major, I have to read a novel a week or a novel every few days or whatever, plus on top of all my other reading for other classes. In fact, it was probably, if you cut it down, it was probably about 150 pages a day average, depending on the coursework. Lord of the Rings, when I was in high school, it must have taken me 3 or 4 years to go through the whole trilogy, in all honesty. And it's just something about the way those books are written that make you want to read a chapter and set it down.
Yeah.
And then not pick it up for a little while. Then pick it up, read a chapter, and set it down.
Well, keep this in mind. The edition of the book that I borrowed from a friend when I was in college, when I tried to reread it, was actually a modern edition printed in like the mid-1990s, written in Old English.
What?
Yes.
That's really strange.
It was very difficult to read that, and I wondered if he had any ones.
But translated Tolkien into Old English.
English. It was the most interesting thing I've ever seen that I had to try to conquer it.
That's very bizarre.
That's really strange.
There's something about that just seemed to sort of fit in my head, but... yeah, I don't know if I could really say what I related to in the book, because I did watch the movies, and I didn't really hate them, but there was something missing. Something felt missing.
Something was missing. And I think that it's hard to hate the movies unless you love the book.
I think that might be
accurate.
I love
the books, and I didn't hate the movies. I did hate the second movie, but...
Yes, that was very fairly so. People who just saw the movies didn't really like the second one.
Yeah.
Where are we in terms of time? 57 minutes. So we're approaching the end of this conversation. Any final thoughts about high fantasy?
One quick thing to bring a selfish end to this, since we didn't cover this before. Where I come from with high fantasy is I started with it sort of in Magic the Gathering.
So I see
it as sort of a way to bring people together, and that's what that's what I want to keep in mind here.
That's a good point.
So you see high fantasy primarily socially?
Yes. Because it had this way of bringing my friends together, to tell you the truth, when I was growing up, so.
It's interesting. I mean, and the same is true of D&D.
Right.
Yes.
And that's probably, and really, Rudy, that was probably your big introduction to high fantasy. It would be D&D, right?
Well, I'd read the Lord of the Rings before that.
Oh, you had read the Lord of the Rings
before. But never, I never really participated in any high fantasy. So.
Right.
Yeah. I'm still sort of picking on what I participate on. But high fantasy as a whole, pretty good. Don't confuse it for epic necessarily, which is something I brought up earlier, because epic and high seem to, like, go together.
Right. And I think there's a distinction needs to be made, because when I think of epic fantasy, I think of, once again, Beowulf, Odysseus, the Arthurian stories, and I think the type of protagonist is is a real distinction. I think epic fantasy is about a big protagonist conquering big obstacles, whereas high fantasy is about a little protagonist conquering big obstacles. Where all the other, the black and white morality is pretty much the same throughout. But I think it's a difference in the scope of the protagonist.
Right. Exactly. I totally agree with that.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
And the D&D thing may be another reason why I'm kind of jaundiced, because so much enjoyment out of D&D style high fantasy, and the campaign we ran was kind of high fantasy-ish. So much enjoyment out of that in during the same period that I was enjoying The Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And that's been tainted with some kind of cynicism, too, I think.
Yeah.
And a sense of loss.
Yeah.
Final thoughts from you, Rudy.
I want to make it good. Let's see.
Dun 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 dun
dun dun dun dun dun.
There.
Basically, I think if I had been Boromir, I would have just used my military might to smite the fools who didn't want the ring to be used as a weapon, and I would have used the ring as a weapon.
So you wouldn't have traveled with the Fellowship at all?
No, I would have just...
It would have just been fuck you, pay me time, as far as hobbits would have concerned.
Yeah, pretty much. And I liked Boromir at first.
Right.
Because he was like, fuck you, use it as a weapon.
Yeah.
But, but it was like, nah. After that, it was kind of... I thought he went on a sad decline.
Basically. Yeah, until he's saving himself, or sacrificing himself to save hobbits.
Yeah, I was like, boy, that's kind of sad.
Yeah, that was kind of a downer.
That's my final thought.
This coming from the guy who wanted Sauron to win.
Yeah, oh no, totally.
Yeah. Sauron... Well, in that scenario, Sauron does win, though, because he corrupts Boromir and he gets control of the army of men, and...
That's true.
Yep.
Shit goes downhill. Yeah. Okay, next episode, we are going to be talking about Demi-Lich. We'll have playtested it then. Pretty high contrast, very different from Final Hour of a Storied Age. And we'll probably have some bullshit topic to talk about as well.
Yep.
So that's it for Mom's Basement Podcast, episode 26. The Hank gradually loses his voice over the course of a six-hour playtest in a one-hour podcast edition.
Yep.
Signing off.